Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rap Bastard. Joe is not on this episode this week. Well, he is. He has sent in his freaking and geeking, but last week, he and his wife took off for parts unknown. They had a vacation. They got away, so he was not able to record. So it's me doing the solo thing, but it's not going to be a Solitaire Rose Radio. No, it's an episode of Crazy Comics and Stories, because this is something that I wanted to bring up for a while, and Joe has kind of said in the past that he doesn't have much to add to the topic. Now, one of the things we do, I'm kind of letting you behind the curtain. Every week, I send a few topics to Joe that I've had percolating in my brain. Sometimes it's pretty easy. It's the previews episode, or we do some reviews. Although we haven't had time to do reviews lately. I may do a solo episode of reviews if this schedule problem keeps happening. But I will toss out a bunch of topics, and we will decide which one to go with. And there are some where I know more than Joe, there are some where Joe knows more than me, and there are some where Joe says, I don't know much of anything about that. And this is one of those. I wanted to talk about public domain comics. I have talked about it in the past. You can download all kinds of comics legally. Older comics, comics from publishers that don't exist anymore, publishers that have had their stock bought up, all sorts of things. We even have one company that I believe, when they closed down, literally said, all right, everything's public domain that we haven't sold to other publishers. No idea if that's true or not, because I no longer have the issue of the Comic Buyer's Guide that I believe it was in. But I can say that you can find all of their work out on the internet pretty easily. So, let's get into public domain. And to talk about public domain, we need to talk about what public domain is. There are a lot of misconceptions about public domain. Public domain does not mean nobody owns it. Public domain means everybody owns it. What it is, there are works that, when they came out, were copyrighted. That copyright only lasts for a specific amount of time. The reason for that, when the whole idea of public domain was invented, was so that the creator or company that owned the copyright can make money off that copyright for a specific amount of time. Different countries have different time. Then it would go into the public domain, which meant everyone owned it. Now, this can be for inventions, this can be for books, art, comics, etc. And what it means is, once something enters the public domain, anybody can make a copy of it. Anybody can sell it. We all own it. For example, in the 90s, there was a drug that came out called Viagra. And Pfizer owned Viagra. And they held the copyright on that. Now, they also own the trademark, and we'll get onto that in a little bit. But they own the copyright on that drug. And they had the right to be the only people to make that drug for a specific period of time. When that time ended, any drug company, anybody, can make Viagra. Now, because it's a drug, you do have to get it approved by the FDA. They have to look and make sure that you're actually using the same chemicals and everything, and you're not adding rat poison or Tootsie Pops to it. That's why you get inundated with emails about buying the blue pill. They can't call it Viagra. Viagra is a copyrighted term. Or, like Claritin, which I am so glad it has gone into the public domain, because Claritin was very expensive when it came out. And now I can go on to Amazon and I could buy Lortridine, which is the same chemical as Claritin. They can't call it Claritin, but they can call it Lortridine, or in this case, Allerclear, which is a name for the Kirkland people at Costco who packaged the chemical. The same thing happens with books. So let's go to the book Dracula, because Dracula is in public domain. The book was written, it was published, it was in copyright for a certain amount of time. When it fell out of copyright, anybody could make a Dracula, could take that novel and print it. They can do an audio adaptation of it. They can do a radio adaptation of it. They can make a movie of it. That's why there have been so many versions of Dracula, because Dracula is in the public domain. Anybody can make a copy of Dracula. I could create a, what is it, sort of a shop on Amazon, create an ebook of Dracula, format it in a way, do whatever I want, and I can put it out. This is why, after a book goes into public domain, you will see versions of a book that have commentary in them, or you will see different translations, because the main work has come out of copyright. But if you translate it, you keep the copyright to that translation for a certain period of time. That's why when you go to buy a copy of Les Miserables, there's a number of different translations, but there's one translation that's about 1,000 pages long. That is the main one that people use. And no, it was kind of the first, and it's the complete and unabridged. So if you're going to do a translation of Les Miserables, you have to actually get the French version and translate it yourself, because that translation is copyrighted. Same with the Bible. Bible's a public domain book. However, what book publishers found out in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was, hey, if we do our own version of the Bible, our version we could copyright. That's why you had in the 70s the Good News Bible, which was written with a lot of 60s slang for the hippies. And that was everywhere because while publishers know the Bible sells really well, they can't copyright it, but they could copyright their version. And different churches will copyright their version. So on and on like that. And the same thing is true of newspaper strips, short stories, novels, pulp magazines, comic strips, comic books, things like that. So what is the difference between copyright and trademark? Because something can fall out of copyright. And it does after a certain number of years. Here in the U.S., I want to pull that up. Public domain. Because one of the fun things at the first of the year, there's always a list of these works have fallen into public domain. And they do that every year. So, let's see. All right. In most countries, the term of protection for copyright expires the first day of January, 7 years after the death of the latest living author. The longest copyright term is in Mexico, which has life plus 100 years. Notable exception is the United States, where every book and tale published before 1927 is in public domain. American copyrights last for 95 years for books originally published between 1927 and 1978, if the copyright was properly registered and maintained. For example, the works of Jane Austen, Lewis Carroll, Edgar Allan Poe are public domain worldwide since they all died over 100 years ago. There are websites that we will get into that handle public domain works. That's why I think it was a year ago when The Great Gatsby fell into public domain. Immediately, there was a comic book publisher who, we are doing a graphic novel adaptation of The Great Gatsby. Why? Because once it fell into public domain, they did not have to pay the F. Scott Fitzgerald family or the publisher that was holding that copyright. They didn't have to pay them to do the adaptation, which is kind of why it's weird that they did a adaptation of The Great Gatsby, and I think it was either 2010 or 2011, when they could have just waited a few years and done it and not have to pay anybody. But, so, the thing about maintaining a copyright, it used to be a shorter period of time and you had to renew your copyright. And you could renew your copyright after a certain number of years. But you also had to post that it was copyrighted. The most famous example of this is the movie Night of the Living Dead. When they put the movie together, it was called Night of Anubis. And that had the copyright notice on it. And George Romero and Image 10, which was the company he created to make Night of the Living Dead, sold the distribution rights to Walter Reed, who didn't like the title, so they made a new title, Night of the Living Dead, and they created a new title sequence. There was no copyright on the title sequence. Movie went out, you know, did its business, started to become very popular, and all of a sudden people realized there was no copyright on it, so anyone could make a print of the movie. Now, Romero has done a number of things to try to get that copyright back. Part of the Dawn of the Dead was an attempt to get the copyright back. There was also a novelization where they could say, hey, you know, we've done a novelization proving blah, blah, blah. They also did a remake in 1990 that was directed by Tom Savini that was an attempt to get the copyright back. None of those worked. Once a work goes out of copyright, it's public domain. Anybody owns it. That's why in the 80s, when you went to a video store, there were all these different versions of old movies like Angel and the Bad Man and Night of the Living Dead. And It's a Wonderful Life. Now, the weird thing is with It's a Wonderful Life, it had slipped out of public domain. I'm sorry, it had slipped into public domain. And because of that, that's why it was shown on every UHF low-power TV station through the 90s on Christmas Eve. Because it was free. Anybody could show it. You didn't have to pay any rights fees. And then all of a sudden, the people the family who owned the original short story it's based on went to court and said, hey, this is based on this story, therefore we own the copyright to it because this is a work derived from our copyrighted story. Judge ruled in their favor. So that family now owns the copyright on It's a Wonderful Life, which is now why it's only shown on NBC instead of every channel in the, because they then said, okay, we own this, we're going to license it, who wants the rights? So that is how you can lose your copyright. So again, what's the difference between copyright and trademark? The original Tarzan novels, the first four or five, have all gone into public domain, which means you could go out on the internet and you could download them. You can go to Amazon and you'll see a ton of different people have made, you know, you can download ebooks or collections of those stories. However, the character Tarzan, the name Tarzan, is trademarked, which means you can't call any of those novels Tarzan. If you were to write a novel based on those four first novels, which you can, because they're in public domain, it means you can use all of the elements from it, including the character Tarzan, but you can't put Tarzan on the cover. And for comics, there's a great example of this. One of the most popular characters in the 40s was Captain Marvel. Owned by Fawcett Publications, they had a number of books. It sold millions of copies. At one point, it outsold Superman, which DC said it was a knockoff of. I think, now, while DC was winning the court battles, if you go back and you read the stories, they're vastly different. The characters are vastly different. They have some things in common, but not enough. And I think if Fawcett would have fought it up the chain, they would have kept the, they would have won. However, by 1951, 52, 53, Captain Marvel wasn't selling really well. So they had lost another court fight with DC, and they looked at their sales and they said, rather than continue this fight and appeal, it's not selling well enough, we'll just discontinue it. They discontinued Captain Marvel. Fawcett eventually kind of got out of the comic book business. They did distribute comics. They distributed Archie Comics in the 70s. They distributed the Dennis the Menace comics. But they quit publishing comics altogether. So the Captain Marvel went out of copyright. Now, they hadn't bothered to trademark it. So you had in the 60s where all of a sudden, two people, Myron Fass, who published a bunch of crappy comics, and Martin Goodman, who published Marvel, both realized Captain Marvel has fallen out of copyright. And if it was trademarked, it had fallen out of trademark. So Myron Fass very quickly put out a comic called Captain Marvel and the Meets a Terrible Five, which Joe and I have talked about in the past. It's about a character who, when he yells split, his head, arms, and legs fly off and can work individually. Marvel, however, once that comic disintegrated and only lasted, I think, two or three issues and just faded away really quick, Martin Goodman said, we need to have a Captain Marvel comic and we need it on the stands right now. We got to claim this. Get it out there so we could copyright and trademark Captain Marvel. So Stan took a book that had been a reprint book, Marvel, Fantasy Masterpieces, changed it to Marvel Superheroes. He and Gene Colan slapped together a quick story that would be the origin of Captain Marvel. They did two stories that were in Marvel Superheroes. When you look at them, you could see that they were put together really quick to secure that trademark and copyright. And that's why, even though Marvel's Captain Marvel sold poorly, they kept doing the book. They wanted to keep that copyright. They wanted to keep that trademark. Now, when Fawcett completely cleared out, they sold all their characters over to DC. That's why DC has Blackhawk, and they have all the Captain Marvel characters and all of those. Everything Fawcett published, all of those characters were sold to DC. So DC has the rights to the original Captain Marvel, but they can't call him Captain Marvel on the cover of the comics, because Marvel owns the copyright on Captain Marvel, which is why in comics and in the movie, and I think even in the comics, they've changed his name to Shazam. That's why it's Shazam. And when they brought the character back in the 70s, it was Shazam, the original Captain Marvel, but they got rid of the original Captain Marvel after a while, because Marvel probably was like, hey, you can't do that. So that's kind of how trademark and copyright are part of this. A character can remain in trademark, but his stories can go public domain. Tarzan is the example that I know the best. John Carter, Warlord of Mars is another one. You probably remember Dynamite had a John Carter comic that they just called Warlord of Mars, because John Carter was copyrighted, but Warlord of Mars was no. John Carter was trademarked, but Warlord of Mars was not. So they put out comics featuring the character because those early novels had gone into public domain. This also falls under a weird little quirk that happened. 1989, there's this tiny little comic book company called Malibu. They found out that the original Mickey Mouse comic strips, Disney had not bothered to renew the copyright on them, and they had fallen into public domain. But nobody had touched them because it's Disney. And they were scared if they put out a book or a collection or some other thing featuring Mickey Mouse, Disney would rise up and stomp on them. Now, they got together with their lawyers and said, how can we publish this stuff? Since it is public domain, Everybody owns it. We want to publish that. So what they did, they put out a comic called The Uncensored Mouse. Joe and I have talked about it a couple of times in the past. It had a black cover with just the logo, The Uncensored Mouse. On the back, they would have an example of the strip. They never mentioned Mickey Mouse. They were polybagged. So that, you know, basically they could say, no, nobody knows. You know, we're not saying that it's Mickey Mouse, and people can't look through it and see that it's Mickey Mouse. And on the back, it would be the world famous mouse. These are adventures you've never seen before, blah, 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 blah. Well, it didn't matter to Disney. Disney sent him a cease and desist. And because Disney had a lot more money than Malibu Comics did, Malibu ended the book after the second issue. It also didn't sell that well. I was working at Schindler's at the time, and Schindler's was always big on anything with controversy because they figured if it got in the news, people would come into the shop. I remember when Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses came out. We were not a shop that sold literary novels. We sold cheap paperbacks. Matter of fact, at the time, we didn't even sell hardcovers unless they were remaindered. But when The Satanic Verses was all over the news, oh, did we have copies? Any book that got in the news, any magazine that became controversial, anything that became controversial, Schindler's had it because they knew, hey, Schindler's is a newsstand. It's where people go to get magazines. And it's, oh, I've seen that in the news. I'll pick it up. So they got about 50 copies each of The Uncensored Mouse. And they sold a couple. And I bought them because I'm interested in comics history even back then. But Malibu backed down and quit publishing it. And then in 1996, Marvel bought Malibu. They bought up everything Malibu had done. Men in Black, they own. The Ultraverse, etc., etc. Everything from Malibu, including their spin-off publishers like Eternity and Aircell and all that. Marvel owns all that. Then, in 2008, 2009, Disney buys Marvel. So to me, there's some sort of fun, ironic twist to the fact that Disney has now owns the company that published The Uncensored Mouse. And those strips have been republished by Fantagraphics through their Disney archives, where they are publishing the old Disney stuff for the collectors. The Carl Barks stuff, the William Van Horn stuff, the Don Rosa stuff. You know, the Disney comics that people think of when they think of the good Disney comics, as well as the early comic strips and things like that. So, if I were to publish these comics or books or whatever that are in public domain, what is to stop someone from just taking my book, scanning it, and publishing it again? Legally, nothing, unless you do what a number of publishers did in the 80s and 90s, and probably still do today, and that is they change things. They add some art, or they erase some art, or in book publishing, they will remove some sentences, or add some sentences, or do something that makes it so it's theirs. That way they have the copyright on their version. I know dictionaries are well known for putting in words that aren't real, so that if another dictionary comes out and has that word in it, they could go to court and say, hey, this dictionary is just copying us. It's also why dictionaries will add new words. People say, oh, they're doing it because the language is evolving. No, they're doing it so that they can keep that copyright, because every year it's a new book. Now, copyright used to be, for a shorter period of time, and the laws around it were different, in that when I was in high school and college, my creative writing teacher would tell us, after you've written a story, take a copy of it, put it in an envelope, and mail it to yourself and keep that envelope sealed. Why? Because that sealed envelope has your story in it as well as the date that it was sent, so that if you send your story out to a publisher and they publish it saying, no, you don't own that, we own that, you've got proof that you did it first. You don't need to do that anymore. Once you create a work, it is copyrighted automatically. You don't need to send it in. You don't need to fill out a form. Now, you can do those things for added protection. But for the average Joe, well, Joe's not here. For the average Corey, just the act of creating it, you have the copyright. And that means that when you go to a publisher, you own all the rights to that book. Now, the standard publishing contract will say, we are buying these rights from you, or we are leasing these rights from you, or we are buying first publication rights from you, which is why you will see, both in book publishing and also now in comics with licensed material, that material. Let's Marvel had Star Wars. And when they lost the license to Star Wars, everything they created was not owned by Marvel. It was owned by Lucasfilms. Lucasfilms was able to take that and give those comics, the rights to those comics, to Dark Horse. And Dark Horse could publish all the stuff that Marvel printed. And then when it went back to Marvel, Marvel's able to do trade paperbacks and omnibuses and put on their digital all the Star Wars comics that Dark Horse did. So you would make, when you're selling your work, you're selling rights to it. That's why Stephen King, in his contracts now, this company publishes it, but he keeps the audiobook rights and can sell those to whoever he wants. He can sell them to that publisher or not. Or he can sell the movie rights or the TV rights, etc., etc. He's a big enough guy that he can keep all the rights except for the publishing rights. And if he wants, if it's in the contract, once they do a certain number of printings, he can pull those rights and give it to someone else. Or, like he used to do in the 80s, he would actually give first publication rights to these small press publishers who would put out very ornate collectible books, and then the second printing would be with the big publishers like Signet or Macmillan or on like that. Another thing that changed with copyright was in the 70s, and this is why a number of comic artists actually left the comic business during that time. Before the 70s, work for hire was very murky. Which is why you had a lot of creators who created characters in the 60s and 70s suing for the rights back, because there weren't specific contracts. There weren't specific laws. Things were murky. And you'll see that with the lawsuit of Jack Kirby's family against Marvel, where they said, hey, he created all this stuff and he wasn't paid a proper creator's fee for it, and it got all the way up to the Supreme Court, and right before the Supreme Court was supposed to hear the case, Disney settled with Kirby. They just settled with Ditko. They over at DC, they've settled with Siegel and Schuster over characters. Things like that. And a lot of that is because it used to be you didn't have a contract per se. Your contract would be on the back of the check. On the back of the check, it would say that you release all rights to, you know, the company, blah, 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 blah. It would actually be a rubber stamp on the back of the check. And for you signing your paycheck to deposit it, you were effectively signing that contract. Well, by the middle of the 70s, by 76, you couldn't do that anymore. So both Marvel and DC had to go around, and when someone turned in work, it's okay, here's your work-for-hire contract. And there were a lot of artists who said, I'm not signing a work-for-hire contract Frank Brenner's the one that I think of the most because he refused to sign a work for hire contract and never worked at Marvel again. You've never heard him talk about ever working for Marvel again, even when Marvel was giving creators rights with Epic or Icon. Nope, Brenner wanted nothing to do with it. He felt that they'd screwed him over. There are other artists who are like that as well. It's also why it got murky with Howard the Duck. Because Howard was created by Steve Gerber, and the contract he had for the comic strip, the Howard the Duck comic strip, he owned part of the character, whereas in the comic book he didn't. So that's why he sued for ownership of the character, because of that different contract. The contracts were in conflict about the character, and his lawyer said, hey, you can work that out. Remember, he didn't win that lawsuit, and Marvel didn't win that lawsuit. They settled the lawsuit. So that is what happens when it comes to copyright and trademark with comic creation and everything. So, long story long, a lot of comics have fallen into public domain. There are some where it was a fly-by-night publisher and they never copyrighted what they did because they didn't think to give a damn about that. It was, okay, we're putting this stuff out. It is disposable. It's like a newspaper. Kids will read it and throw it away. And we're on to the next one. On to the next one. These were more the fly-by-night publishers. Marvel was a little like that. But one thing Martin Goodman was good at was trying to own everything. He had learned that from his days in the pulps. But there are a number of sort of sleazy publishers who came from the darker end of the pulps who got into comics, and they didn't care about copyright. They didn't register anything. All of that stuff is public domain. There are also the publishers who went out of business pretty much before the 60s. If they went out of business before the 60s, everything they did was public domain. Because back then you had to renew your copyright every few years. They didn't renew the copyrights. When you get to after the 60s, it gets murky. And there are some publishers and websites that deal in public domain. And they will say, yeah, we could check at the Library of Congress, which is where all of the records for all of this stuff is kept. And if something has fallen into public domain, we're going to pounce on it. But if there's any question as to whether it's public domain or not, we're not touching it. One of the best examples of this is at Timely Atlas, which became Marvel. The first 10 issues of Rawhide Kid, way back in the 40s, Marvel didn't renew the copyright on them. Rawhide Kid lasted a short time. It was canceled. It was then brought back when the Westerns became big again. But those early, early issues from the late 40s, they never renewed the copyright on. They're public domain. Now, most of the public domain websites aren't going to touch it. But the publishers like Guandanaland that I've talked about, or PS Art Books, they also traffic in printing public domain stuff. Once they know it's public domain, they're going to print it. There are also companies that in recent years, you know, within the last 40 years, have gone away and their works are public domain. The biggest one is Warren Magazines. Warren Magazines went under. Jim Warren kind of vanished. There was a company called Harris that bought up his warehouse. They thought they had bought the copyrights and trademarks to everything. They had not. They had just bought the warehouse. They were able to fight to get the trademark to Vampirella, but creepy, eerie, 1999, all of the other stuff. They didn't secure trademarks or copyrights on, so those are all public domain, which is why Vampirella was at Harris and now it's at Dynamite, because Harris was able to sell all the trademarks and copyrights over to Dynamite. The others, now Dark Horse published the line of Creepy and Eerie, but if you look in them, you know, they'll say they are copyrighted by Dark Horse. that's only that version of that. You could go out to the Internet Archives and download all of it. It is public domain. You can get it. The other company where it gets really, really murky is Carlton. Carlton, in their last few years, they put everything up for sale. And there is a web strip creator, John Lustig, who bought a whole bunch of the rights to their romance books, and he has turned it into a strip where he will take a panel from it and reword it, and it's called Last Kiss. It was in the Comic Buyer's Guide. He's now doing it online. Really funny. I enjoy it. Also, the action hero characters. DC bought them as kind of a gift for Dick Giordano, who was the editor who created them. The only one that was not part of that was Thunderbolt, which was actually owned by the original creator. It was at DC for a while, but then he took the rights back, and his family controls the rights to Thunderbolts. That's why it has shown up at a couple other publishers other than DC. Other than that, it is believed that when Carlton went out of business, they released the copyrights. I have read everything on both sides of it. I honestly believe that when Carlton went out of business, the copyrights were released. Because they didn't just, you know, it's not, okay, we're selling this off. They tried to sell everything they could, and the stuff nobody wanted, oddly enough, the Ditko horror, the westerns, the drag racing comics, things like that, nobody wanted. And now a lot of the Ditko stuff is showing up in collections. A lot of the, there's the Lonesome War of Willie Schultz, which was in one of their war magazines, is showing up at Dark Horse, owned by the creators who may have, you know, it also depends. The creators can go to court and say, I never sold my copyright, and the court may or may not agree with them. But it's probably also because they're creating new material for the character, saying, hey, we've created new material, therefore we own this. I don't know the legal ins and outs, but I do know that if you want that Carlton stuff, the drag racing comics, the romance comics are sold, but the drag racing comics and the horror comics and all of everything that's not one of their licensed books, because they did a lot of licensed books in the 70s. You could get it out there. I believe it is all public domain. There's there's arguments about it, but no one has come out to say, nope, I own the copyright and you can't publish this. And that's another thing about copyright. If you don't protect your copyright, if you don't protect your copyright or your trademark, you can lose it. How do we know this? There was a time where Cerebus did a four-part story. There was the Roach, and the Roach was a character who was nuts and would take on whatever hot superhero there was. And there was a time where they did a four issues of Wolver Roach with Wolver Roach on the cover, and Marvel finally sent a cease and desist letter, and Dave Sim got upset, and his friends at Marvel said, look, you're putting a Wolverine knockoff character on your cover four times in a row. Marvel has to do this in order to protect the copyright. Otherwise, another publisher can publish a Wolverine character and go, see, you didn't protect him. That is one of the reasons why Marvel's able to do the Squadron Supreme, which is a very close knockoff of the Justice League. Because DC didn't do anything about it in the 60s or 70s. And so by the time the miniseries came out in the 80s, DC made some grumblings, and Marvel had their lawyers say, look, we've been publishing these characters for almost 20 years now, and you haven't done anything. They are different enough that they could be considered a parody. That's one other thing. Parody was not considered free of copyright until Mad Magazine. And Mad was doing a thing called Sing Along with Mad, where they would take show tunes and famous tunes, and they would have humorous lyrics, and it would be sung to the tune of blah, 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 Well, Irving Berlin saw this, said, they're ripping me off. And he went to court, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, nope, copyright and trademark does not cover parody. Parody can be put out. And I think in the ruling, one of the judges said, you can't own iambic pentameter. So as long as, that's why Weird Al, he can put out a parody song of anything he wants. But he has permission because he feels it's important. And I think it's one of the things that has led him to be so successful in the music business over the years. Whereas a lot of people who did song parodies, just they came and went really quick. He asked for permission, a lot of the art, you know, he's been around long enough now that artists will actually come to him and go, can you please do a parody of my song? So, where can I get public domain comics? There are two main places that I go to. The first one is comicbookplus.com. When you go there, you'll see it is number one, free and legal, established 2006, comicbookplus.com. You can register. It's free to register. I have registered. You can also set up to contribute. I have contributed from time to time because, hey, running a website's not free. Costs money. They give me a lot of enjoyment. They give me a lot of stuff that I can use for historical research. And you can download on this site public domain comic books, public domain comic strips, non-English comics that have fallen into public domain, pulp novels that have fallen into public domain, pamphlets, brochures, newspapers, magazines, British story papers. And they have a thing called the virtual newsstand where you can put in a date and they will have, here are all the comics that were out on that date. For example, I'm going to go to their most recent list. They say that month or two, they've had 90 books uploaded, such as All Fun, Volume 5, Number 4, which was from Al Soloway Limited. There is Fighting Air Force, which was from Superior Publishers Limited. Dr. Diamond. Somebody took all the Dr. Diamond stories from the old magazines published by, Temerson, and put them into one book. They took all those scans and put them into one book. Joe Palooka Comics from Harvey has gone public domain. That's in there. Tor, which was a comic that Joe Kubert did for St. John Publishing. They have all of that. There is Little Max from Harvey Comics that has fallen into public domain. Top Adventure from IW Publishing, number one. Let's see what else they have here. Bill Boyd Western, number 17. That was a Fawcett book. Little Genius, which was a Carlton promotion comic, scanned and put into public domain. Most of these are from the last week. See if there's anything else really interesting here. Oh, Timmy the Timid Ghost, which was a Casper knockout from Carlton. That's in there. Teenage Love, another Carlton book that's in there. A lot of French books, a lot of L'Agent, which is a French language book, fallen into public domain. Now, I really like Comic Book Plus. They have a great layout. You can search by character, you can search by comic, or you can search by publisher. I usually search by publisher. The other thing to look for your public domain comics, is the Internet Archive. And that is archive.org. They don't just keep a snapshot of web pages through time. They have books, videos, audio, software, pictures, anything that is considered public domain is available on the Internet Archive. anything that they put up that they find is not public domain, they take down. So that does make it pretty easy. Millions and millions of books and movies and TV shows. But for me, I go to books. Let's see, where is the comics? Yep, you go to books. All books. And then you can sort by comics. And they have new stuff up all the time. They have manga that has gone into public domain. They have old novels such as here, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. That book has fallen into public domain. You have to do some searching in order to find things. But they have the most complete collection because they're basically the 1,000-pound gorilla in the public domain area. And those are really the main two to go to. There is another site. Let me pull that up. Public Domain Comics. Comic Book Plus. Digital Comic Museum. And that's digitalcomicmuseum.com. They also have public domain comics. They sort them out on the main page by publisher as well. If they don't have it at Comic Book Plus, you can go over here to see if it's there or vice versa. But those are the places where I get my public domain comics. And I do read a lot of public domain comics. Sometimes I read them for entertainment. Sometimes I read them for the history. Sometimes I'm doing research on artists. There's some stuff that I wish was in public domain. The Kirby Mainline Publications, which was a line of comic, which was basically the Simon and Kirby self-published comics. They are not listed as public domain, mostly because Joe Simon was still alive, and I believe he was able to renew the copyright on them. He was very zealous about his copyrights and his trademarks and stuff. But those are the ones that, when they fall into public domain, I will be really excited about, because there you've got Fighting American, Boys Ranch, Black Magic, their Love Comics. All of those were published by Mainline. Some of them were distributed through Harvey, some of them through other publishers. But that is where you could get public domain comics. Now, if you are looking to start reading public domain comics, there's a lot. I mean, I'm just going to the Digital Comic Museum, Ace Magazines. Ace Magazines was a comic book and pulp magazine publishing company headed by Aaron A. Wynn and his wife, Rose. The Wynns had been publishing pulp magazines under the Periodical House and A.A. Wynn's magazine publisher's name since 1928. They published comics between 1940 and the end of 1956. There are 752 comics there. How are you going to know what ones to read? Well, you're going to have to start picking and choosing. And for me, the best thing to do was to, I started with the stuff I knew and the stuff I had read about and the stuff that people had written fond essays about. So I'm going to go over some of the ones that I think are a good start and where you can find them. So, now Carlton's got a huge list of stuff here. And most of it is their stuff from the 40s and 40s, 50s, and 60s. But with Carlton, there's stuff that you want to look for. Anything by Steve Ditko, anything Ditko had anything to do with. He did a lot of the horror comics in the 70s, such as Baron Werewolf. That's the one that pops into my head. But I'm first going to go to Fawcett, because everything Fawcett did is in public domain. And they do list here, Warner Brothers, current owner of Fawcett Copyrights, legal representation has informed us that several Fawcett books were not in public domain and must come down. You can read more about it in the forums. They have a link there. But Captain Marvel Adventures, Captain Marvel Jr., and Wiz Comics were all of the Captain Marvel comics. And those still hold up because C.C. Beck and the group of people he had working made them as children's stories. They are whimsical. They aren't so much like Superman. Superman was deathly serious, whereas the Captain Marvel stuff was more children's stories. It was more wish fulfillment. They still stand up. They're still very readable. The art is really good. And I would start with the 26-part serial, which was the Mr. Mind story. Now, one thing to remember when you look at comics from the 40s and 50s is racial stereotyping is way over the top. That was what pop culture was at the time. And if you have trouble with that, you're going to have trouble with these books. I don't agree with the racial stereotyping, but you also can't go back in time and change pop culture. And I think that when Warner Brothers puts out their stuff, they have a disclaimer saying that there are racial caricatures in these cartoons that do not reflect the belief of Warner Brothers and were prevalent at the time, even though they were not appropriate. It's the same thing here. You get that in old Marvel books. You get that in old DC books, especially when you get to the war books, where they really go over the top with the racial caricatures of the Japanese. They don't do as much with the Germans, because Germans had been in the U.S. for so long that they had kind of gotten into our culture. But they're even, they even do a lot of way over the top Italian stereotyping in those books, because Italians were also thought of as not part of the pop culture. It was, the thick accent, the grandmother who didn't speak any English, etc., etc. So when you read this stuff, you have to be aware of that. You have to kind of know what you're getting into. Another book that I would point out as being great would be, let me pull it up here. It's from Quality Comics. And the reason I point out Quality Comics is because for a lot of these, they were from the Iger Eisner studio. And in many of these, Will Eisner was involved in them. So you've got Quality, which had books such as, let me get it here. There we go. Black Hawk, which was a fantastic war comic. Reed Crandall did a lot of the work on Black Hawk. So once the series gets going, the art is amazing. The stories are okay. Military Comics, which was a superhero book at the time. Torchy was a early Good Girl comic, and what they meant by it was always listed in Overstreet as good girl art, and I always thought, what does that mean? And it's all in how you say it. Man, that is good girl art, which meant that they drew the girls very sexy. And Torchy was actually funny and interesting, so that works out well. Those are the ones under Quality that I would recommend. There are some early Archie comics, mostly their superhero stuff. Blue Ribbon was their main superhero book. Those have all gone into public domain, as are the early issues of Pep Comics, which were superhero comics, and some early Archie stuff. Lev Gleason was one of the Quality publishers and had some great selling books. The ones that I would recommend are Daredevil Comics. At one point, Daredevil was one of the best-selling comics in the U.S. Daredevil and the Little Wise Guys. as well as Silver Streak, which was one of the earliest superhero comics. Really enjoyed that stuff as well. And let's see. Harvey Comics has some stuff in it as well. Their horror stuff from the 50s, while it's not nearly as good as either Atlas or EC, I would recommend them. There is Witch's Tales. What is that other one that they always show? Chamber of Chills. I just got a reprint of Chamber of Chills. That stuff looks pretty good. Fiction House was an American publisher of pulp magazines and comics that lasted from 1921 to the 50s. They're the ones that gave us Sheena Queen of the Jungle and a Spirit comic book. Now, the Sheena Queen of the Jungle is very much the old-fashioned knockoff of Tarzan with the sexy girl instead of Tarzan, but it's still the white savior coming to save the stereotypical African savages. So you could take that for what you will, but the art is very good. I enjoyed that. And the other thing that Lev Gleason has that I passed over, I completely forgot, was Crime Does Not Pay. At one point, Crime Does Not Pay was the best-selling comic in the U.S. It outsold Walt Disney's comics and stories. The first batch of issues in the early 40s are hard to get through, but once George Tuska comes on the art, it really sort of comes into its own. They are still crude. They're still crude comics, but there's a visceral excitement to them, which will explain why they sold so well. It was very much a, here's a criminal, they do all these horrible things, but then in the end, the police catch them. Which is a lot like the gangster movies that Warner Brothers put out. The last of the public domain stuff that I want to point out, also from Quality is, I think I did publish, Plastic Man and Police Comics. Plastic Man is so good. You could publish the stories now, and 90% of them, people wouldn't be able to tell they were old stories. It's when they have the racial caricatures. It drags down the story and really points out that they were from the 40s. But Jack Cole's cartooning was amazing in that stuff. They hold up so well. They're so beautifully done. There's also comics that Basil Wolverton did. There are also comics that Al Feldstein did before he went over to EC. But the last one I want to point out are all the Warren books. Yes, the Warren books, except for Vampirella, are all public domain. You can get them on the Internet Archives. Download them all. Read them all. Some of the best horror comics ever printed. They're one step below EC. They had their ups and downs. You know, the first 5 years of Warren were incredible. And then they kind of took a dip. And then in the mid-70s, they started back up as you got Doug Mensch and Don McGregor and Bruce Jones and other people coming in to start writing the books. Louise Jones, who's now Louise Simonson, was the editor. Then after she left, Bill Dubay took over as editor. And not as good. I would say the last 2 years of Warren are really bad, except for the occasional story from Doug Mensch or Don McGregor when they were going between Marvel and DC and looking for work. But still, the first 10 issues of Creepy and Eerie are some of the best comics you're ever going to read. So that is it for public domain. And now, Freaking and Geeking. Here's what Joe is freaking on.
Hey gang, your own pal Crazy Joe Ryder here, and you're probably wondering to yourself, hey Crazy, why can't I find your eBay store anymore? Well fans, I shut her down. Pause there for dramatic effect, and for those of you who may have passed out, yeah, to quote Popeye, I've had all I can stands and I can't stands no more. For you long-term listeners, when we started out this show, I didn't have an eBay store going, so you wouldn't hear my eBay segment and Corey telling me all about my favorite part of the show. And when I finally got off the road from my job and I stayed home, I reset up my eBay store. And since then, I've been selling stuff not only to you, but everybody else. Part of the fun is, of course, sharing some of the fun stuff I've found. Like one of my favorite was when I found this little, mini comic sized, I think it was Captain Marvel Jr., only to discover these were actually on General Mills cereal boxes. You could not find them in mint shape because in order to get them off the box, you had to tear the back cover. And if you did find them mint, that means they were actually sold, I don't know what you'd say, like loose, I guess, in a container pack. So just kind of a little fun piece of comic history and things like that. Hopefully you listen in when we do that, and not everybody, you know, does. I'm sure some people skip. They don't want to hear me pimping my eBay store. Well, don't have to worry about that anymore. As you know, eBay has decided they don't want to carry adult items, never mind the 50,000 plus listings for Playboy, Penthouse, and the like, or, you know, all the sexual aids and things like that. They got a new bank processor and they get all goofy. I'm telling you, this country's just back-assward when it comes to sex. Ooh, we can show it, all these girls bouncing around on Boob Watch and all these other shows, but by God, try to sell it in comic books. Think of the children. Even though I've run across that before, I was having problems with Zombie Tramp. Always interesting because eBay says, yeah, we don't want to sell it, but we will sell it if it's an art. In this case, you could argue, yeah, she's naked on the cover. She's not naked inside, but whatever. They decided they didn't want it. We'll come back to that train of thought in a second. Anyways, I got zinged a couple times. First one was on a Frank Frazetta art book from Eros Comics. Hey, baby, you're the greatest. If anything, maybe the softest topless cover, but most of it wasn't nude. I was confused, but whatever, I waited. And then, of course, later somebody else posted theirs, so I reposted mine, sold it. Then, of course, Zombie Tramp, the aforementioned one where the covers were naked, inside wasn't. Maybe it was, I don't recall reading them. But somebody kept reporting them. Well, the latest one was I got dinged on a Belladonna comic from Brian Peluto. Probably remember Brian Peluto. We'll get back. Well, Lady Death, you know. Same thing. The difference, Belladonna is kind of like Conan, and Lady Death is really her own thing. I'm like, whatever, I must have missed it. I thought I scrubbed all the books that would be violating. And when I got home and I looked at it, it wasn't naked cover. I don't even know if there's any nakedity in it, because it's sealed. I didn't get a chance to look at it. It was one of those gold special covers that Avatar is really fond of. I responded to eBay, hey, this comic has no nudity on it or in it. Why was I dinged on adult titles? And they give me a lot of hurrumph, hurrumph, hurrumph. You're not supposed to carry adult titles. And I'm like, okay, you're not listening to me. There is no nudity on it or in it. I did not violate your no adult comic thing. And they put me on pause for a while, I should say hold. And they came back and they said, this is the clincher. Belladonna is one of the titles we will not allow you to list. Okay, where does it say that? And it took a bit of conversation going round and round and round. And finally, they admitted, we don't have it published publicly. It's on a list of titles we won't carry. And they gave a few examples. Black Kiss. Okay, sorry, Howard Chicken. Tits and Clits. Underground Comics. I mean, just the title should give it to you. Bizarre Sex, whatever. There's a whole list of titles. The thing is, they don't have it publicly listed. And that's what got me angry. Round and round we went. It's like, well, how can I be dinged on something when I don't know it's wrong? Well, you know, you can always ask before you post it. And it's like, there are hundreds of thousands of titles. How do I know which one's going to run afoul? What's worse is the same comic that I got dinged on and suspended, somebody reposted. And they thoughtfully said, well, you know, you can always report it here. Zing number two. I don't want to spend my day being your personal censor, eBay. Facebook has their stupid algorithms that basically cut people off for the dumbest, most innocuous of things. eBay is telling me they want me to be their personal censor, which means every time I've been reported, swear word coming up, some motherfucker was nosy enough to be offended and report me. Corey thinks I have a personal stalker on eBay. And I don't think it's that. I think it's somebody else going, well, that offends me. I'm going to get off it. Or more likely in the case of Zombie Tramp, it's probably another dealer like, oh, this motherfucker is selling it for less. So therefore, I'm going to report him and get dinged. Whatever. I can get that you don't do Belladonna, but I still argued, It's not nudity. It's a redhead, large breasts, in a halter top, wearing a kind of a, I don't know what it was, some type of kilt with a skull, with a big battle axe. Take the same thing, put it on Conan, he gets to run around topless. Take the same thing, put Donald Duck on it, he gets to run around pantless. For some reason, someone reported it. My guess is it was probably another dealer, but that's just me. And of course, I go on the eBay chatbook page, or they call it their community, trying to say, hey, what am I doing wrong? As I'm waiting for eBay to come back and tell me what their decision is. And you know, I get dumbasses like, well, you violated their modeling clause. No, I didn't. I violated their adult comic clause. Somebody else, well, you know, she's wearing something that I can see nipples. And somebody else jumped in and said, no, there are no nipples on this. Do you get prudish when Conan does this? This is fantasy art. It should not have been reported. I concede, yes, there probably is a Belladonna comic where she's got her legs behind her head and she's naked. That's just part of Avatar. They did a lot of variant covers that way. But it was just aggravating that I got dinged, suspended, because of their super secret probation non-public list. And the fact that I went on and there were other Belladonna comics made me think, well, this one's not even naked. It should be fine. Case in point, nobody's reported my Dynamite covers, you know, because I guess that's acceptable to allow Red Sonja or I can say her name from John Carter, Deja Boris. She can be topless, but, you know, whatever. And the other thing that was crazy is like, okay, fine. You know, this is one of Brian Peluto's creations. He does another character called Lady Death, where you have over 15,000 titles. Is anybody reporting them because she's a large-breasted, well, pale white woman? The thing is if you ever get into that when you're talking with eBay, if you got dinged or something's wrong, the people you talk to are powerless. They're basically just putting out the fire because not one of them could lift my suspension. Not one of them could lift my strike. They would concede, yeah, the list is private, but then just a bunch of corporate bullshit doublespeak. And that infuriates me because I put a lot of work into my eBay store. I've been on since 1998, selling since 2001. The week before, you heard me on the podcast saying how I spent 2 days cleaning up everything, trying to get the Red Sonja and the Vampirella listings going. I always talk about how I go to shops and I'm buying their cheese because I love to take it home and flip it. Not only discovering things that I didn't know before, titles, artists, creators, but also discovering that, yeah, they may have had it for a buck. And I understand it because I was a retailer. Different economics. You want to sell your stuff cheap. And then you discover, no, it's actually a $50 item. I say this, and again, I forget the Korean lady who does this. I had joy doing this. I did not mind doing it. However, eBay just destroyed all the joy. And then you talk to the chuckleheads who are like, oh, yeah, well, this is why you got suspended. This is why you got suspended. No, that's not why I got suspended. You are not listening, and I'm not inclined to argue. The whole gist of the matter is I got dinged on something I didn't know was wrong. And judging by the last couple freakings you have, you know, sins of omission, I have a very hard time with. Rather than stay infuriated, and I had no idea how long the suspension would last, and worse, if I did it again, if somebody decided, oh my gosh, you got Uncle Scrooge and he hasn't been wearing pants for 80 years. I'm offended. My suspension would be a week. And then the next one, I guess, they would just ban me. And I'm like, how long does this last? And again, corporate doublespeak, Babylon talk, you know, they just wouldn't give me a straight answer until, well, you know, they can technically go back as far as they need to see if you've been dinged on this listing. So that means 5 years from now, some motherfucker could go all the way back to now or before and say, hey, he's been dinged before. Cancel. I'm a small fry on eBay. They gave me a lot of pump up bullshit. Oh, you've been with us a long time. You're actually one of our better sellers. Yeah, well, not enough to get a strike removed, not enough to get any sympathy, because again, the peons at that level of eBay can't do a fucking thing. All they can do is try to mollify me, but I'm polite because I know I've worked service industry. I know they're not the ones that make these horrid decisions. And worse, they don't make the policy and they probably don't care. They're probably on the other side of the world. I mean, the last time I talked to somebody from eBay, they were actually in India, which I thought was fascinating. I mean, I talked with them for about 5-10 minutes on that. I said, this is amazing that you're on the other side of the world and we can do this. Not anymore. So what I did is I shut down my eBay store I will probably be back once I cool down, maybe get a little time between here and there. I'm going to explore some other avenues. I may offer to put some things up on our Facebook page and say, hey, my eBay listeners want this. A lot of guys online that I talk with have said, well, you should try this, try this, try this, try this. And again, wonderful choices. Some have the same problem, like my comic shop. Again, myopic with, oh, you showed half a nipple. No, that's Vampirella. She doesn't show nipples. Maybe in the cosplay, but that's a different subject. Again, I'll cool down. I call it, you know, turning chicken shit into chicken salad. There's other things that'll be positive about that. And I'm going to pause for a second. Corey, what are you freaking on?
All right. And for me, I only have two things I'm freaking on. They're both about layoffs. Valiant Comics, which has been back since, let's see, when did they fire back up? I want to get that right. It's from May of 2012, has announced that in September, they're going down to one book a month. I think the reason for this is basically that they got bought up by the new company as kind of an IP farm. It's okay. Marvel's making a bunch of money with superheroes. Here's this superhero universe that's sitting out here waiting to be plundered for movies and TV and everything. So they bought up Valiant. The Bloodshot movie came out basically the week the pandemic hit and shut down theaters and shut down everything. And then when it came out on digital and streaming, no one seemed to really care. And in a lot of ways, I think they were pinning their hopes on that because they were publishing a lot of comics with some bigger names, and they just never sold. You know, I would look in the sales figures, and they were selling maybe 10 to 12,000 copies. And then after the Bloodshot movie came out, they lowered the number of books they're putting out. They started moving more toward, okay, we're going to have a trade paperback. We're going to cancel Exo Man of War and start it over again. We're going to have more miniseries. When a company starts doing that, you know they're kind of sputtering and not doing well. And they've announced that they will have one book a month. It's going to be a Bloodshot miniseries. No, a team-up miniseries and then a Bloodshot miniseries for the coming future. Lots of people were laid off. I think that Valiant may kind of sputter on like that as kind of an IP farm, looking for someone to buy it up. The other thing is that Oni has started laying people off. Joe and I talked in the past about how Oni was having some financial trouble. They are starting to lay off office staff now. Not a good thing. Oni has a lot of good books that they've published. But once again, a lot of these places are looking for either to catch on in the young adult market or get a media contract. And if they don't get either of those, they just, there's not a lot of money in publishing comics. And Oni has not been publishing books that people are going nuts for ever since Scott Pilgrim. I love Kaiju Max. Didn't sell that well. I'm loving the Chris Samnee book. It's selling okay. But a lot of their other stuff just flies under the radar. So those are the two things I'm freaking out. Joe, what are you geeking on?
Okay, now back to my chicken shit, chicken salad. So we've already talked about the chicken shit, the eBay stuff. Now my chicken salad. I got a table coming up at the MCBF show on September 25th. I'm sorry, 27th. It's a Saturday. What's cool is I'm going to bring a bunch of stuff from the charity booth that's been sitting around because we're not doing big shows anymore for different chicken shit reasons, and I want to try to keep this positive. So I'm going to bring that. My old partner Pat's bringing some stuff. I got Kelly's stuff. I've got my stuff, including a lot of stuff on eBay. If you saw something you liked on the eBay store, first of all, you can always contact me through eBay or through the email of the show, and I'll cut you a deal on it. There was a gentleman that I traded with, Travis, and he traded me some Nikita Koloff comics and a Blip magazine, the video magazine we talked about that had Spider-Man and Spider-Man Stan Lee playing the Spider-Man game. And he was like, oh, send me, I don't know, some of the Steve Ditko stuff. So I packaged up every single Steve Ditko comic I had and sent it off to him. And I think I gobsmacked him because he sent me a note saying, oh my gosh, that's amazing. So I'm going to be there selling stuff. I'm going to be exploring other retails. I'll also be able to do some things that I don't normally do. I went to a comic store, a couple of them. I went to the Source. I went to the Comic College, which, by the way, is beautiful. I went there the first week they'd set up, and they were just doing new stuff. They've got that place set up, and it's just amazing. You walk around, much like the Source, much like Dreamhaven, or even our good buddy Steve Brown's store, Cedar Cliff, and you're just, hell, issues needed. Almost every comic store in the Twin Cities, you just go in, and you're like, where do I start? And you know you're going to miss something you wanted. So I'll definitely be returning. But what's fun is buying comics that I wanted versus ones that, oh yeah, I can flip this. I still kind of fall into that trap. I found a really bunch of cherry mint issues of Marvel's Greatest Comics at half price for 50 cents. I was like, holy cow. Not only are they great reading in color, whether I keep them or sell them to someone, you know, I have that option. Speaking of selling, the other fun thing, and my wife's going to love this, I can finally try to get the basement under control. You know, it's been an ongoing fight, I don't know, ever since I bought comics. Just trying to keep my collection under control. I lost it when I had the stores. I lost it for a while. Traveling. Now I can get everything organized. I can sort. I can get things out of the things I'm going to keep into my storage bin. I can keep things that I'm going to sell. Maybe organize it. I may run across $100, $200 comic and put it on eBay. I may run some auctions on eBay. So I'm not going to disappear on eBay. It's just the things I put up will be like 30 days. I may mention them when we do the podcast. And again, keep the crazy bookmarked, K-R-A-Y-Z, because again, when I come back, it'll be a big thing. I mean, I'll tell you about it on here, let you guys have first crack at stuff, because that's the way I roll. So again, I'm just trying to turn things. Oh, the other thing I get to do, go out and see life. Go see some museums. Take a walk. Go enjoy the summertime. Right now, I'm in the middle of Wisconsin. Don't ask me where. A friend's cabin. Lake to the left of me. Beautiful woods to the right. And I'm just going to go out. Just have a fun time. So, again, I had joy doing eBay. I'm going to get that back, I promise. Because half the fun is just... Actually, that's going to be kind of our new segment that Corey and I are going to do. Look What I Discovered, where we take a comic book or maybe a comic series and just say, look what I found. This is amazing. And we can share it with you. So instead of just having, here's what Joe's doing on eBay, we'll say, well, here's what we discovered either on our collection and things like that. So kind of like a mini review, but I think you never know what it'll morph into. For me, it's like finding just singular issues and sharing them with you. Because the secondary goal of this here podcast is to mention every single comic book ever published. And we got a long ways to go. So that's it for me. Corey, what are you geeking on?
And now here's what I'm geeking on. And it's all comic related. I've actually had some time to read comics this last week. Because, as you know, I told the group home that I was taking Fridays off. Wasn't going to work Fridays anymore. I was able to do that for 3 weeks until they twisted my arm and started throwing bonuses at me. So this week, I start working Fridays again. I'm going to try to get out of it. Hopefully, they'll get some people hired. But I like having my Friday nights off because every other night of the week, I'm busy. I work Monday night at the group home. I work Tuesday night at the group home. I work Wednesday night doing the AEW stuff. And then Thursday is when I record with Joe, or if I'm not recording with Joe, I'm doing other stuff. Plus, it's, yeah, well, I basically, when I get done with Joe or I get done with the podcast mixing, it's 10 o'clock and I need to go to bed. I'm actually recording this at 10:30 on Thursday night. So Friday, I am done with work. I still have to cover AEW Dynamite, but that's only an hour long. And because it's a recorded show, I don't need to, oh my God, I have to get it done right now. I can take my time and do, I think, a better job covering that. So, and then I have Saturdays off, and Saturdays when I go, oh my gosh, I have a, look at all this food that's gone bad in the fridge because I haven't had time to cook or do anything. So this week I've had some time to read comics. First one I want to point out, Love Everlasting, number one, which is from Image. It's written by Tom King and drawn by Elsa K. Carantir. And if you look at the cover, it's a parody of the old love comics. And when you read it, it starts off like a love comic. And then it switches to a different love comic with the same female lead as in the first story. And then it does it again. Only this time she knows that something's not right. And then it does it again. And this time she really knows something's not right. So by the time it's over, you're like, what the heck is going on? Which is what I want from my comics. Give me enough of a story that I grasp what you're doing. But give me a hook so that I go, I don't know where you're going with this. I got to read more. It's also Tom King, one of the writers that I really enjoy. This is his first creator-owned book. It's interesting. I don't know where he's going. I'm excited for it. And on our buy, borrow, and ignore scale, I give it a huge buy. Although I'll probably tell you to wait and buy it as a trade paperback. The next comic I am talking about, Mad Treasure Trove of Trash. This is a new series. It is a Barnes & Noble exclusive. It's a $10 comic. It's going to be coming out bi-monthly. It's a lot like the old, what were they called? The Mad Super Specials. It's 100 pages of reprints. In color, on nice paper. It's different from the regular comic in that it's larger, it's square bound, and you can only get it at Barnes & Noble. You can't subscribe to it. I saw somebody talking about it. It's weird that it's not available in previews, and no one has thrown a fuss about it. But I went and I picked up the first two issues. They reprint the good stuff. You know, they're reprinting stuff by Paul Coker Jr., by Mort Drucker, by lots and lots of stuff in here from Sergio Aragonés and from Al Jaffe, including one that I remember as a kid, Mad Solutions to Big City Doggy-Doo Problems, which is his thing for how to get rid of dog poo on the sidewalk. And Al Jaffe, when he did his inventions, they were always weird and they were always funny. Just an enjoyable stuff. It pulls most of its stuff from the original Gang of Idiots. So it's not a lot of the stuff from the 90s and 2000s. It's mostly the older stuff as well, but it's stuff that has aged well. They do put in here that, let's see. There we go. The text of these articles are presented unaltered with cross fingers for historical reference. That means that stuff in here that may be a bit objectionable because of changing times, they're just going to reprint it the way it is. I think it's a really nice package. It's sad that it's only available in Barnes & Noble. I actually had to get the first one off eBay because it had already sold out before I even knew it existed. But again, when Mad was, quote, canceled, unquote, we said they're going to need to keep the name, they're going to be repackaging things. There's the regular comic, which is bi-monthly, and then there's this, a Barnes & Noble exclusive. I don't know how long it'll last or how well it does, but currently it's a bi-monthly book. The next thing I am geeking on, the first issue of X-Men Legends is out, written by Roy Thomas. It is the Wolverine story for everything that takes place between Hulk 181 and Giant Size X-Men number 1. And Roy Thomas, who was involved in the creation of Wolverine, was writing a lot of Marvel at the time, was Marvel's editor-in-chief at the time. One of the things that is interesting about it is when I think Roy Thomas, I think a lot of continuity stuff and a lot of very purple prose. One of the things that Roy has done over the years is he's been able to modernize how he writes comics. It still has the good story beats. It still has a packed plot, but it's not the endless blocks of text that comics were like when he was editor-in-chief or when he did comics. He has moved along with the times, which for a guy in his, what, I think he's in his early 80s, the fact that he's able to do that, even if he's just in his 70s, the fact that he's able to write a comic that appeals to modern readers is incredible. And I like the fact that X-Men Legends tapped him on the shoulder and said, hey, would you like to do a story? Because Roy wrote the X-Men in the 60s. He's the guy who was in charge of the X-Men. Stan tapped out of the X-Men pretty early and handed it over to Roy. I think it was Roy's first superhero book. His next one was The Avengers. And The Avengers at the time was not considered a big-name book either. It was sort of, okay, we're giving Roy the second-tier books so he can learn what he's doing. I really like Roy Thomas's writing. And I like Roy Thomas as a person. I think he has a lot of history and a lot of knowledge, and it's good to see him still getting work at Marvel because he's an untapped resource. The first issue of Marvel's Predator came out, and I'm giving it a buy as well. The story is actually pretty simple. The lead character is someone whose family was killed by a predator, so she is hunting for that predator, going from planet to planet where predators are being, where people are finding, you know, people are messaging that there's a predator, it's set in the future. There's some pretty good plot twists in it. I thought it was a well-done Predator story. Predator, for some reason, has a lot more trouble getting a good movie than the Aliens franchise does, although they both have run into trouble over the last 20 years. I hear the new Predator movie is really good, but I thought the comic was entertaining. Even over at Dark Horse, the Predator comic always came in second to the Alien comic. I think Marvel's version of Alien was okay, got hit by a bunch of delays, so they're restarting it. But their version of Predator, I enjoyed this issue. And I'm not a huge Predator fan, but I was happy that I read the issue. Next up is Batman by Chip Zdarsky. He took over with issue 125. And it is Zdarsky doing the main story, and there's a Catwoman backup that's also by Zdarsky. He is starting a story with a new Batman villain who kind of has Batman's number and has been taking him apart piece by piece. Yes, this has been done before, but I really enjoy how Zdarsky is putting the story together. He's also bringing in all the supporting characters, the Batman family. And issue 126 ends with a huge twist that made me very happy as a Grant Morrison fan. So Batman is in good hands. I think one of the things with all the different Batman comics that are out there, they really try to go out of their way to make sure that the person writing the core Batman book is kind of making that's the core book. The comic Batman is the core book. That's the one that we want our kind of the big name talent on. The other book I've read, I am up to issue 15 of the new version of Moon Knight. I really like this book. They've actually pulled in some continuity from, I think, the third or fourth Doctor Strange story. They are using the multiple personality thing in a way that doesn't piss me off. Because a lot of times, they make Moon Knight as if he's batshit insane to the point where he's a danger to everybody around him. And it's a fine line because if you write the character like that, you can't. It's all about, is he helping people? Is he a superhero? Can we trust reality? Which is good for a story here and there, but if your whole run is like that, you're not going to be able to get invested in it. I think this run is much better in that he is Mr. Knight and he has set up an agency in an area of New York where he protects people. I think it's very well done. I like this version of the character. I think the art is fantastic on this. I like that they're adding new supporting characters. That's another thing with Moon Knight, is that they got rid of all his supporting characters and never did anything with them. And now they're bringing in new supporting characters. And a supporting cast is what makes a comic. Spider-Man would not have lasted as long if he didn't have the best supporting cast in comics. Moon Knight's supporting cast works for me as well, to the point where I read the Ms. Marvel Moon Knight team-up issue, and I really enjoyed how they brought in the supporting characters and introduced them in that book. And that's what a team-up book should be. It should be a book that introduces the fans of one character to another. So if you are a Ms. Marvel fan, you read it and went, oh, so that's what Moon Knight's all about. And if you're a Moon Knight fan, you read the Ms. Marvel and went, oh, that's what Ms. Marvel's all about. So, really enjoying that. And the last book is 8 Billion Genies. I reviewed the first issue, really enjoyed it. I have now read up to issue 4. And they're doing this gimmick that I love. You had everything happen in the first issue, and then the second issue is 8 minutes later. And then the next issue is 8 days later. And then the next issue is 8 weeks later. And then on and on and on and on and on. And they're playing by the rules. And in the fourth issue, we start to find out even more about what's going on, why it's going on. And it's just this wonderful unfolding mystery. So you've got the gimmick of everybody gets a genie and everybody gets a wish. And how does that play out? But now it's okay. Why are people doing the wishes they do? Why is this happening? What's going on here? What's the story behind this? Charles Soule has really put together a good book. I'm at the point now where I would say just wait and get the trade paperback. But wow, what a fun story. Very well done. I'm enjoying it. And I'm really glad that I took a chance on it after Joe said, oh, that looks good. Believe it or not, kids, you've listened to me blather on for the most part about funny books for an hour and a half all by myself. And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most. Hit my music. Funk is on a roll.
Done, bitches!